Coming up today, we'll talk about securing our social media accounts, passwords, and defending against security threats online. AFA Assistant IT Director Nate Farmer will be with us.
Do not accept a friend request from someone unless you have physically met them several times and you actually really know this person.
Then, AFA's Research Fellow of Church and Culture, M.D. Perkins, talks about the changing attitude towards so-called same-sex marriage and what that means for the church in the days ahead.
I think there's a lot of dangers for Christians in the years ahead, and we have to walk carefully, we have to be wise, but we also have to be clear about what the Bible really does say about this.
Thanks for joining us today. I'm Jeff Shambly, and this is The Stand Radio. Well, it's great to have you with us today. I think we would all agree that God has given us the command to be faithful stewards of everything He's given us. And, you know, part of that stewardship is to avoid potential dangers. You might not think of your social media accounts as something you need to protect, but the fact is, they're loaded with potential security problems. In 2023 alone, more than 349 million people were impacted by data breaches. Well, joining me is Nate Farmer. He's the Associate IT Director here at AFA, and he is involved in keeping people safe online, and he's got some great ideas to share with us about our social media accounts. Hi, Nate. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Jeff.
What are some of the ways that social media accounts can leave someone vulnerable?
For me in general, it's pretty much if you have any online presence in a way that's going to be compromising for most, but anytime you interact online, you're always going to be giving out something in return, whether that is your personal data, your shopping habits, all that kind of stuff. But in terms of social media, it depends on how much you're willing to share to someone. Because if you're like me, you're very limited on how you use social media. I only use it for literally finding information, going on forums and stuff like that just to get the information I need, never really putting out too much. Well, now I am. For example, I've gone back and I've actually redacted a lot of my own personal information from a lot of social media platforms to actually minimize the case of someone being able to use that against me to kind of target me with just kind of what I call social engineering and stuff like that.
So, we'll get into some of that in just a few moments. But in an initial conversation that we had about social media accounts, let's just say that I'm going on vacation. So spring break is coming up. I'm taking my family to the beach. I've got my Facebook account. I'm posting pictures and letting people know where I am and what we're doing, having a great time. What's wrong with that picture?
Well, you're letting everyone know, hey, I'm not home.
Oh, okay.
You know, and if, now granted, if someone wants to get you, they're going to get you regardless. But the best time to get somebody is when they know you are not in your house. You are not there to prevent someone from either entering in or give them a reason of, hey, there's a good chance I'm going to get called by the police on these people. Now granted, if you have a security system, that should handle that kind of stuff for you.
Right.
But in general, realistically, if you are on vacation and posting stuff, it's not going to be as dangerous. But if you have someone who is, let's say, for example, I've had a couple of friends in the past when I was in college that were stalked by a couple of people and stuff like that, they can use that information to find out where these people, where you're located. So,
okay. And so, and actually, we both agree if someone really wants to get into your personal data, they can probably do that.
Right.
We're talking about reasonable steps that you can take. But look at photographs. When you put a photograph online, what kind of information is in a photograph? Let's say Facebook, for instance, because that's a popular platform.
I mean, in any case, like for example, let's say you're out in the yard with your kids taking pictures, enjoying nice Easter weather, something like that.
Sure.
You add in a picture with your kids standing near, let's say, your mailbox or a good picture of your house from the road or something like that. Well, you now have given where your location is by saying, hey, here's my mailbox. Here's where my house is. Again, it's just more of a being aware of how much you're willing to put online. Like, for example, I've got a almost 2-year-old daughter, not there just yet.
Yeah.
But there will be probably a point where it's like, hey, let's not post this on social media. If you want to share it with your family and stuff like that, send it to them through text messages and stuff like that, in which there's I can get into the whole spiel on that, because even there's stuff now with phones in general with photographs and photo apps. I can just go on a rant about that, but that's a whole other thing.
All right. What about people who are wanting to be your friend? Anything to be aware of when we're approached with people who are introducing themselves on social media?
I personally would say, do not accept a friend request from someone unless you have physically met them several times and you actually really know this person. Just because, and again, in general, someone can be seem like they're a good individual, but on the flip side, they could just be a con artist trying to get your information and stuff like that.
Okay, put your hacker hat on for just a second. If you're thinking like a hacker, what kind of information are you looking for when you are following someone online? Let's see, YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, any of those apps.
Every bit of your life detail, what school you went to, what your dog's name is, what your uncle's name is, who's in your family, who's not in your family, who have you had memorial pictures posted of, what is your favorite place to eat, what is your favorite thing.
Well, that's not like a credit card number. These are a lot of different. Why these kinds of details? Because I would typically think, okay, you want my PIN. You want my banking account information and my PIN, but you're listing a lot of other things. Why is that?
Unless you have just gone and posted your credit card on a social media page, you're not going to be able to get that kind of information unless you're doing like phishing scams. That's a separate thing. But in general, if I have information, and some stuff is starting to get away from using security questions, stuff like that, everything I have listed is usually a lot of common security questions that are listed for secured personal information. A lot of your banks will do that kind of stuff. A lot of just security stuff in general will do that. So if I have information, I have your email address, I don't have your password. They're better about it now, but in the past, that used to be a good way to get easy access into someone's accounts and information without having a lot of the keys to the city, per se.
Okay. Let's talk about privacy settings because in any app on a smartphone, I've got the decision of what I want to be, what I want to make public, what I don't. What about privacy settings? What would you suggest is a good rule of thumb?
For just smartphones in general?
Yeah.
Or for,
let's stick with mobile devices.
For that, I would say download as little free games on your phone as possible. Because anytime you install a free game at all, not saying that they are stealing your everything that your screen is recording. Some have done that, but not everything. Okay. But you are giving, in some cases, access for the phone with, of course, they have contracts with like the major corporations to collect this data. But that's why you get personalized ads, because they are going and saying, okay, they play our game. We're now going to serve them information based upon the stuff that is trafficking through their phone, through other people's what I would call endpoint searches, that kind of is like, hey, this person searches here on Amazon. Hey, this person buys here at Walmart, stuff like that. They keep track of that stuff and they will share it back and forth. So if you don't want blatant advertisements that are meant to scam you, then don't usually buy those kind of or download any of those kind of free games in general, or just apps in general that say, hey, we're going to boost the performance of your old dying phone by 40% if you just install this one app. No, you are welcoming someone to possibly do something malicious to your phone.
Okay, very, very good. Let's talk about one other thing, passwords. So I'm of a generation where we take a sticky note and we write down our passwords and the date that we used it. Okay, I changed it on this date, and we keep it in the top drawer of our nightstand or something like that. So let's talk about passwords. What is the rule of thumb to use when you're setting up a password? You got to remember it.
Right.
Okay.
I personally use a password manager now, and if you ask me, could you write down the password to your, let's just say my credit card account?
Yeah.
Nope. I got no idea what that password is, but I know it's stored in my password manager because it has made it for me and it has pre-generated it. So that is one way to keep up with stuff. Now, I can go in and I can look up the password and stuff like that.
Sure.
But in general, that is how I keep track of all my passwords. And for what a password manager is, it's just a digital app that's on your computer, extension in your browser, or a app on your computer that lets you store all your passwords digitally that will allow you to keep them all in a locked vault where you have one master password to get into them.
Okay.
And at any point in time, you can just type in that one password. That's all you got to remember. And it has everything listed there for you in a neat little organized section.
Okay.
So and then there's like some extra do's and don'ts I could get into on that one as well. But
okay. So you could go online and just do a search for password managers and get any number of different apps that you can download to manage those passwords. That's a good idea.
Yeah. Like, for example, the ones I personally have used, if you're wanting really secure, you don't have anything that touches the internet, there's stuff like KeePass you can use for that. If you're wanting something that's a bit more ease of use, you can use stuff like Bitwarden is what I've used in the past. LastPass is another one. Now, if you keep all your keys in one chest, someone gets the master key for that chest, they do have
everything.
So that there is no perfect solution other than, hey, destroy every piece of technology you have, go move out in the woods and don't have any running electricity.
Nate, very good advice. Use your social media, but use it wisely. Nate Farmer, thanks for being with us and sharing this information.
Anytime.
Well, this year marks the 10th anniversary of a landmark U.S. Supreme Court decision effectively legalizing so-called same-sex marriage in America. Now, 10 years later, there's a marked difference in the way that the population feels about same-sex marriage. My guest is M.D. Perkins, research fellow of church and culture here at AFA, and author of the book Dangerous Affirmation: The Threat of Gay Christianity. And he's also the producer of the documentary In His Image, Delighting in God's Plan for Gender and Sexuality. Welcome, MD. It's good to have you.
Good to be with you, Jeff.
You wrote an article for American Family News just a few weeks ago highlighting a 2024 Gallup study on attitudes towards same-sex marriage. What did they find in that study?
Well, we've seen an amazing shift in public opinion on same-sex marriage. It currently stands at 69% of the population is in support of same-sex marriage. Now, if you go back to 1996, that support was only there at 27%. And before 1988, pollsters didn't even ask the question about same-sex marriage because it wasn't even on the agenda. It wasn't on the table. So between 1996 and 2011, 2011 is really where it flips from majority opposition to majority support. And that's just a handful of years before the Obergefell decision. And by 2014, it was at 55% support. So even between, just within the last 10 years, we've seen a 14% increase in public acceptance from where it was just 10 years ago.
That is enormous.
It is.
You know, when you think about that, okay, so 2011 was the year that it flipped from those majority opposing to majority supporting. In your research, and you've written the book Dangerous Affirmation, as we've mentioned, The Threat of Gay Christianity, what was going on in our culture that you recall and you remember back in those years leading up to that Obergefell decision?
Well, I think people have been under the impression that this is just generational change.
Okay.
But I think the growth actually outpaces generational replacement. So there is a value change that's taking place. And I think you could really boil it down to about four things. I think there's interpersonal relationships play a role.
Yeah.
Coming out became a very big part of the LGBT movement throughout the 90s. Coming out in your workplace or in your home or in your town and kind of making a big statement so that other people see and can recognize someone who is identifying as gay or lesbian, so that it kind of puts a face on it. It's no longer a statistic. And we're seeing those shifts happening when someone says that they know somebody who identifies as gay or lesbian, they're far more likely to be accepting of homosexuality than to be opposed to it. Also, media depictions are a major part of this. And this is not just a Christian talking, working for AFA. Of course, you know, pointing out media depictions is part and parcel of what AFA has been involved with going back to the very beginning. But secular sociologists acknowledge the shift that has happened in public opinion because of media depictions in entertainment in the 1990s. So, I mean, you're talking about, I mean, it's Ellen, it's Will and Grace, but even more than that, they were just interwoven within stories and character lines throughout the 90s on television and in movies. There were depictions of gay characters. They might be a side character or something, but it was just, it was all part of this normalizing effort to make homosexuality not seem so scary, so abominable, but to seem like something, oh, this nice, funny guy is also gay on this TV show. And so it's all part of the shaping influence. And then, of course, you have the legal and political decisions that have changed the way we think ethically about these things. And when you change someone's ethical thinking, you tend to change their moral thinking as well. And so there have been those shifts. And then because we're Christians, we have to think about this spiritually. It's not just sociological things, but there's also sometimes the unclear and uncertain witness of the church on this, where either we've seen Christian denominations shift in their public positions on homosexuality, or we've just seen them kind of recede and grow less willing to even address the issue. And you're seeing that a lot as well across the church.
Well, that's a convergence of a lot of different things.
It is.
Very good picture, MD, as you pointed out there. And the relationships really strikes me because I've seen that in people's attitudes in the churches where, okay, well, someone is in my family that I want to be sensitive to because I love them and I want to let them know that I care about them. And if I'm seen in opposition to them, then that creates some sort of a rift between us. But that has long-lasting effects. So the seeds that were planted in the 90s have come to fruition in the 2000s.
Yeah. You really did see that because as the marriage battles really were beginning there, you know, in 1996, you have the Defense of Marriage Act, which was signed by Bill Clinton at the behest of a lot of social conservatives pushing that in because of what they had seen with the decision in Hawaii, with the legal decision there. And then that gave birth and rise to this the marriage amendment battles that happened throughout the 2000s. But, of course, those couldn't stand up against the Obergefell decision, which was essentially striking down a lot of the decisions that had already been made legally up to that point. Mm.
How did this Gallup study break down in terms of the demographics? Let's say Republicans, Democrats, men and women. What's the breakdown in terms of acceptance for same-sex marriage?
So there has been a huge rise across the board. Democrats in 2014, for example, were 65% in favor of same-sex marriage. Now in 2024, when the study was done, it was 83% in acceptance. Republicans were less accepting in 2014 at 35%, but in 2024, 49% of Republicans were in favor of same-sex marriage. So you're seeing a growth even among a group like the Republicans who have been part of the opposition to same-sex marriage culturally, but within younger Republicans, you are seeing a very high rise of support. 18 to 49-year-old Republicans, we see them at 52 to 53% support of same-sex marriage. So the younger generation is skewing more liberal on this issue. And as you start to see more of that generational change and replacement, you will see that number probably grow and rise even more.
You know, it makes you wonder, when you're talking about the word conservative, what does that mean? Because typically conservatives want to conserve institutions that we've had.
Yeah.
So really, what you're saying here is that young Republicans are changing really what it means to be conservative. You know, it used to be that you had a moral base to define those institutions. But if what we're seeing is indicative of what the future holds, then we are redefining conservatism.
I think you are, and you already saw that fairly recently with Nancy Mace making a stand against transgender bathrooms. But one of the points she made on her social media account was that she supports same-sex marriage.
Wow,
so this isn't about that. This is about women's safety and all of these kinds of things. But the way that I see it, this is the transgender issue is part of the fruit of Obergefell. So if you are going to be accepting of homosexuality and homosexual marriage down line, eventually transgender bathrooms will just become the next gay marriage issue that things move a little more to the left on, and then that becomes kind of the more commonplace thing to see a rise of acceptance on.
What's the breakdown between evangelicals and Catholics on this issue, Michael?
Yeah, so the religious support is interesting because you've seen a growth across every religious platform. Every religious group has seen an increase in acceptance on this issue for some reason, the Buddhists have declined in their acceptance on it. I'm not completely sure why.
And they're the only ones, I think.
Right, yes. Yeah. So black Protestants, 38% initially in 2014, were supportive to 55% now. Hispanic Protestants, 35 to 43% now. White evangelicals have gone from 28%, now have grown to 38% in their support. And Catholics have been in mostly in line with the mainline Protestants. That might be fascinating to some people to realize that Catholics have been far more supportive of same-sex marriage on this and have grown in their acceptance and have pretty much tended to follow in line with the mainline church on this.
One of the facts that you point out in your article is that views towards same-sex marriage follow the same trend as views toward homosexuality in general. Does this mean that marriage as an institution is less viewed as a biblical entity and more of a social privilege?
I think that's correct. I think more and more people are seeing it as just an optional thing, for one thing. I think a lot of people are seeing it as an optional thing or kind of a social accoutrement,
yep.
But definitely in legal terms, seeing it as a right, seeing it as something that they have some sort of right to, regardless. But you've also seen that shift in terms of sexual orientation and gender identity have been basically enshrined as civil rights categories as well. And so where you've basically taken a subjective internal experience and you've raised it up to the level of a civil rights category, akin to being a man versus a woman or the color of your skin, you know, these things that you can't help. But the civil rights thing is really the linchpin of the LGBT political movement, I see it. And so anytime they can make something a civil rights issue, they will.
Yeah. Let me get your perspective on this, because you've done a lot of research into where the church is headed. What do you think the future holds, and what are the challenges that we're going to face?
Well, I think one of the challenges, just immediately in terms of demographics, is that 18 to 29-year-olds are 47% willing to say that homosexuality is always wrong. So you have a majority saying that it is okay or that you're not really sure. And I think that demographic is rising. And also evangelical women tend to be more liberal in this position than evangelical men for some reason. So more and more, I think the church and Christians are going to be confronted by this issue. Yes, you're going to be confronted by it from outside, but I think more and more it's going to come from within the church. You know, we mentioned interpersonal relationships earlier.
Yes.
One of the biggest things that I learned in researching the book Dangerous Affirmation, I saw that whenever there was a big Christian author who made a public shift on this position, who went from opposing same-sex marriage at one turn to suddenly, you know, years later, supporting same-sex marriage, inevitably, when you got down to it, there was a family member or a close friend who came out as gay, and this individual, this public leader, this Christian leader, changed their position on this issue. Mm-hmm. It ties in very deeply with us at a personal level, wanting to be nice, wanting to get along, not wanting to confront, not wanting to stir the waters. And so it's a real stumbling block, I think, for Christians on this issue, the interpersonal side. And, you know, look, we will have to have a lot of grace and carefulness in terms of how we navigate these situations individually.
Right.
But in terms of holding fast to the truth and standing firm on what the scripture says is something that Christians can't waver on. And that's why I wrote Dangerous Affirmation initially, was because through working on the In His Image project, we were shocked to see how many conservative Christians were beginning to waver and not be clear on this issue. Conservative Christians, not just the mainline churches that were flying rainbow flags out front, but Christian authors and speakers who were suddenly starting to tailor their language a little bit to get a little less clear on the issue, or not wanting to bring certain passages to bear when they were speaking on it because others see them as offensive or harsh or really too strong. You know, speaking like Romans 1 is suddenly off the table because it's too directly opposed to homosexuality. We want to use more gentle language or something, you know?
Yeah.
So I think there's a lot of dangers for Christians in the years ahead, and we have to We have to walk carefully. We have to be wise, but we also have to be clear about what the Bible really does say about this.
Yeah, well said. Well said, MD. One of the things that I see being an issue in the local church is the issue of membership. Mm-hmm. Jonathan Lehman wrote a great book for Nine Marks on church membership. Right. And he defines, he really sort of puts this in a category of, these are the people who are your covenant community.
Yeah.
And so you are in covenant together to be, to uphold certain standards within the church. And to the extent that the church holds membership high, I think that's going to be an issue in the future when you start looking at same-sex marriages, people coming into the church and wanting to join the church, not attend a worship service, but actually to become members. Do you see the same thing?
Oh, yeah. I mean, this has so many ripple effects in all kinds of areas related to church membership, related to pastoral care.
Right.
And, you know, you think about people who come to faith in Christ— who might have been living a homosexual lifestyle or married to a homosexual partner, and then the decisions that are being faced there, and what kind of counsel are pastors and church leaders ready to give if they're already making accommodations to the world on a number of things? There's so many areas of danger ahead for us as we start to pray, and we hope that we see revivals
yes.
in these kinds of ways, and that we're seeing people coming out of these lifestyles and coming into the church. Now, people may say that that doesn't happen, but it does. People do come out of homosexuality. Mm. They can break these bonds. It doesn't matter wherever I speak. Every time I have spoken in a church setting, I have had a man or a woman come to me and say very, very quietly and very privately that they used to identify as a homosexual, and that they were so encouraged to hear me speak on these things with such clarity and conviction, because their stories are not being told out in the main world, but also not often within the church either. That's part of why we made In His Image was yeah. to share some of those testimonies of God's amazing grace in the lives of individuals.
Wow, that's fantastic. Let me give the title of the documentary and where you can get it, and we'll put a link to all of these things on our podcast page. The title of the documentary is In His Image, Delighting in God's Plan for Gender and Sexuality, a redemptive look at what Christ is able to do with sinners in any state of life, to call them out of the homosexual lifestyle and the trans lifestyle. And it's a great tool for your church. InHisImage.movie is the website to go to get multiple copies of the film and other resources. InHisImage.movie. And the book that our guest has written is titled Dangerous Affirmation, The Threat of Gay Christianity. And folks, I encourage you to get a copy of this book. Look at the film. Use this in your church, because we are in critical days and God can do so much through us if we're faithful to the Word of God. MD, thank you for being with us today and sharing.
Good to be with you, Jeff.
And coming up next week, we'll learn how college campuses were once the center of spiritual awakening in America and see how that could happen again. Ty Lamb, director of the Collegiate Day of Prayer, joins us. And with the Easter season coming up, we'll talk about the importance of taking time to focus our hearts on what God has done for us in Christ. Dr. Jonathan Gibson will be our guest. Today's program is available as a podcast at afr.net. To take advantage of a free trial subscription to The Stand magazine, visit afa.net/The Stand. Thanks for listening, and join us next time on The Stand Radio.